This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hello, I'm Sheila Rogers. Welcome to the best of Sounds Like Canada. You're listening to our podcast of the day's highlights of Sounds Like Canada, and you can catch our full show on CBC Radio 1 at 10 o'clock or a couple of times a day on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. Peter Jennings was the longtime anchor of ABC's World News Tonight. He covered all the major news stories of the past 40 years and was a steady presence during shattering events like 9/11 and the Challenger disaster. He brought the world to America every night, but he grew up in Canada. His father, Charles Jennings, was known as the Edward R. Murrow of Canada, and in fact, even when I started 27 years ago, it was a name to be treated with great reverence. Maybe it was destiny and genetics that Peter would become a great broadcaster as well. Peter Jennings died in 2005 from lung cancer. In the days following Peter Jennings' death, ABC aired a special tribute, now a book, called Peter Jennings, A Reporter's Life. Peter's wife, Casey Freed Jennings, was an editor on the book, and she joins me from New York City. And Sarah Jennings, Peter's sister and a well-known voice to CBC radio audiences, she is in Ottawa this morning. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning, Sheila.
And thank you so much for joining me this morning. Casey, this book began as a tribute on ABC in the days following Peter's death. You weren't so convinced that it could be turned into a book. What reservations did you have?
Well, I had no doubt it could be turned into a book. I had lots of doubt about whether I thought it should be turned into a book.
You're as picky about language as Peter was.
Yeah, well, he rubbed off on me. But my concern was, and I think it was shared by his children and Sarah as well, is that Peter never wanted to be the story. And I was concerned that it would be a book that would be a mere tribute to him. And I didn't think that was enough. But when I had a chance to read through the interviews, I realized that we could do something really more substantial than that, that was not only great fun and tell inside stories about Peter the man and the guy behind the camera that very few people got a chance to see, but we could also tell stories about how the business worked, went on behind the scenes, and tell it in a way that hadn't been done before. And finally, we could create a book that was a reminder and an affirmation of the best values of journalism and the value of the very best journalism. And to me, that was very important.
Sarah, did you feel it should be turned into a book?
Well, I have to say that I was sort of the guardian of Peter's privacy. I felt when he came back to Canada every summer, this was the one period of his year when he absolutely had downtime and nobody in Ottawa gave a tiddlyhoots who he was. So I was very nervous about exposing even my own remarks, which had been made after, you know, in the immediate aftermath of his death. But after I'd read what the editors had done, and Casey has worked so hard on this, and Lynn Scher, her colleague, and a young editor called Kate Darnton from Public Affairs Books, I could see that there was a wonderful narrative here. And it's really just amazing how out of the mouths of the people who spoke so warmly and so affectionately about Peter immediately after his death, we've been able to contrive, or they've been able to contrive, this wonderful narrative about who our Pete was.
I think, you know, like to think of it as a conversation between Peter's friends, his colleagues, his family, his subjects. It has that quality of a conversation. And the one thing we did add outside the interviews was I felt it was missing Peter's voice. Mm-hmm. And so we went back and pulled from letters and from speeches and from interviews and also from transcripts and wove his voice throughout the narrative. And I believe it contributes a lot to it.
I was just going to say, Casey, that I felt that because many of the people were interviewed so soon after Peter's death, that there was a kind of raw and unguarded quality to what they were saying.
I think that's true, and it was very honest, and I think there's something to be said for people not having enough time to consider too deeply. It's what they felt, what they believed. And though it's certainly an affectionate portrait in many ways, I think it's also quite honest. People also, you know, they speak about Peter's foibles and I wouldn't say failings, but his foibles, you know, his strengths and his weaknesses. And, you know, oftentimes I believe they are the same. They come from the same place. But it's not a whitewash.
I would absolutely agree with that, Sheila. And I think one of the interesting things about these interviews, which were done in the immediate aftermath of his death, is that people weren't afraid to say what a difficult fellow he could be and how he could drive them nuts. And you know, this came from reporters who worked with him. There was a little trick he used to do, and one of the reporters told me this at the time. You know, you'd come on live on his program at night, and you'd sit down, you'd have all your questions ready to go, and he'd suddenly reach over and flip your tie and say, "God, are you wearing that tie?" Just throwing people off balance all the time, so you'd be ready to strangle them. And I think that sort of quality, these people did speak frankly and honestly when they were actually speaking with deep affection and a tremendous sense of loss when he did die.
Sarah, your family roots in broadcasting run deeply, deeply into this country. And Charles Jennings was a pioneer in public broadcasting. How did your father shape Peter's choice of profession, do you think?
I think that I was reflecting on this week as we get a new president of the CBC, that if you think about it, our family's been involved in public broadcasting in Canada since its inception. So Pete and I grew up in this sort of atmosphere, this environment of broadcasting and certain qualities of broadcasting, which are innate in the notion of public broadcasting. So I think we sort of, it's not quite mother's milk, it was at father's knee. And as children, we had a wonderful childhood. Dad was the head of programming at CBC, for the whole of the CBC, but had his office in what used to be known as the Kremlin, a separate building, which you would remember, next to the main radio building on Jarvis Street in Toronto. And they worked on Saturdays, and Mum needed a day off, so we'd be taken down with Dad. And we were sort of turned loose in the building. The announcers used to take us under our wing. I used to sit under Dad's desk when he was talking to, you know, Max Ferguson, for heaven's sakes.
Who's still alive and well and thriving.
And has quite rightly gained the Order of Canada for the wonderful satirical programs that he did for so many years. So we grew up with this, and our household was full of fascinating people. CBC was the driving force in culture in the country, music, ballet, drama. So, and you know, there was a fair amount of liquid refreshment around those days. People are a little more circumspect now. But, you know, people would come back home with Dad and sit around into the wee hours of the night. So all I can say is Peter and I were like sponges, and I'm sure that's where it started. And Dad was a great man of great values, great integrity, very modest man, really, a very irreverent man in his own way, a serious man who didn't take himself seriously. So I think that Peter imbibed all this. So notwithstanding, Dad probably would have liked him to do something else in life. It was inevitable that he would be a broadcaster.
Casey, how did you meet him?
I met him in London. I was going to school in London in the early 80s, and Peter was still there as the London anchor before moving back to New York. So I joined ABC as an intern, and met Peter then, but actually spent most of my time in a small, dark room that the research shared with the radio folks. So I didn't see him a whole lot at that point. And then I moved back to New York many years later, and that's when I got to know him a lot better.
A lot of the contributors in the book talked about his charisma. And I mean, really, he was a phenomenally good-looking man. And I can go back to the time when I wasn't even a teenager, and I tuned into one of his very early broadcasts at CGOH Television, where he hosted a sort of bandstand show called Saturday Date. I mean, it's absolutely irresistible. But he gave the trench coat such credibility, didn't he, for one thing?
He certainly did. But don't forget, we also saw him, you know, with his hair sticking out in 8 different directions in wool socks and dirty shorts. So he was incredibly handsome, but, you know, he was human too.
That, I always laugh when I hear this, because being his sister, I didn't see it at all. And it's always a little odd when you would go to New York and you'd see your brother up on a billboard driving in from LaGuardia Airport. I mean, I really didn't get it. It just seemed most bizarre.
The job of an anchor, so often the anchor is called upon to be the comm center when big stories are breaking. And like any anchor, Peter would have voices in his earpiece and researchers running around the studio with new information, just kind of shoving it at him, different locations to break away to. Somehow he was unflappable. Casey, why do you think that was?
Because he had attention deficit disorder.
That was what it was.
Peter had this incredible restless energy, both intellectually and physically. And I think it served him well, in a sense, because he could focus acutely when he needed to, but he could do it sort of focus on one thing after another. He had this ability to, even while he was doing all of that, listening to 8 voices in his ear, editing his script, talking, whatever. He was also emailing, or if there was a break and there was a commercial, he was calling to talk about dinner. And then he was going back and taking 3.5 seconds out of his script. He had a remarkable ability that I've, in my lifetime in journalism, like Sarah and Peter, I grew up in the business. My father was in it, and then I started working as a journalist very young and in television in my early 20s. I've never, ever seen anyone who can do what Peter could.
I want to play a little bit of the broadcast from September 11th, 2001. And this is Peter speaking with a cameraman named Evan. Just listen to how everything unfolds.
Hang on just a second. If you look in the upper, look, this now is frozen. And this is an angle of this attack that we have not seen before. At the top of the building on your left, out of the left, become the building. And watch how the aircraft penetrates the building. Go ahead. Completely in one side and out the other.
It just disappeared. It disappeared like a bad special effect. It disappeared right into the building. And more I see it, and as time goes by.
The modern technology enables us to see horror just as we are able to see sport in a variety of different speeds or at a variety of different speeds. And I think you now have a better appreciation than we have had up until now, for which we thank you, Evan, because we see exactly how determined somebody was to do this horrible damage, taking a plane so powerfully and so fast in one side of the building and the other. Tell me more.
What strikes me so much about hearing him then was the insanity and the horror and the chaos of everything going on around him. How he was able to link, how we're able to view horror almost in the same terms that we would view sport. He was able to philosophize at the same time. But also he had what we seem to be lacking very much in our culture, at least in the West and certainly in North America. A gravitas. He didn't turn this sensational event into sensationalism.
I'd like to chime in on
Please
that because,
do.
Of course, the moment I heard that sound of his voice, it immediately evoked my father's voice. He's exactly got Dad's voice. And that takes you back to the whole tradition of Canadian announce staff, which was sort of BBC origins, if you like, the calm, cool, collected observation of the scene, not the sort of high-powered, high-pressured, breathless quality, which is so characteristic of much of broadcasting today. So I feel that this kind of style, this approach, this ability to observe and stay cool under fire, and I'm trying to think, who was the journalist, Sheila, who did the mine disaster in Nova Scotia? In the 1940s, but that same Springfield mine disaster, exactly that same ability under this enormously intense moment to just keep reporting or keep the information going. So Pete, I think, was brought up with those values, and people in the United States who have valued him so enormously, I can never thank Americans enough for the appreciation they had for my brother, but in my mind, they've never really understood what made him just that little bit different than those other great anchors who worked there. And in my mind, it's that calm, cool, collected detachment that he was trained in as a young man. That's how you were supposed to do it.
It also reminds me of is you talk about his calmness and we all remember the chaos of that day. In the book, there's wonderful stories of his directors and the people on the floor of the studio talking about Peter in those situations where they talk about the chaos that was reigning, and he would just take control of the situation and say, everyone calm down. I've got it. I can handle it. I've got it under control here, so you all just calm down. And he could do that, and it shaped the way I think ABC broadcast. I think it was very powerful, and I think it's a very powerful lesson that a lot of the younger people learned and hopefully will take with them.
I think he said something very, very smart about actually being a broadcaster during the tragedy, and that was that somehow, because he was so busy, he didn't feel perhaps the same kind of loss. He put it in a much more articulate way, if I could find the quote.
Yeah, he did, and I think most of us who were working hard that day felt that way, though no one was working as hard as he. But a couple of days after, when he got his first break, I took him down, because I had been down to see some of the makeshift memorials, and we went down as far as we could to Ground Zero and saw all the people coming in from all over the country with their trucks and whatever. And it was the first time he had gotten a chance to be out on the street and see all the posters everywhere, which was just devastating, of the missing people. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time that he felt it viscerally. I mean, obviously, he felt it when it happened. It destroyed all of us. But to be out there on the street was very important, I think, to him that day.
Sarah, how much did 9/11 go into his thinking about committing himself to America as a citizen?
Well, I think it was a central factor. Peter retained his Canadian citizenship throughout his life. He was very... Casey might disagree with this, but he was not, in my opinion, anxious to become an American. He certainly resisted it for quite a long time. But I think the political context in the United States at the time of 9/11 and the post-period sort of changed the rules of the game. And he told me an interesting story. I wonder if I should put this on the air, but I think I will.
I think you must now.
I think I will. That it was that old, you're either with us or not with us. And he made up his mind, I think, that he had to pull the thorn that he wasn't an American and yet sitting in one of the most important news positions in the United States. And he went about it very quietly. He came up to Canada to talk to me about it. I didn't hesitate in the slightest. His family is American. His children are American. America has been extremely good to Peter, gave him a wonderful life, and he loved America. But at this moment, I felt that he felt he needed to identify with the country, and he did so. And he told me about a week or two after he'd had taken his American citizenship, he was having dinner in Chicago, and Casey, you can correct me on this if you like, with Justice Scalia, who's a member of the Supreme Court of the United States.
It was actually, sir, I will correct you just a moment, because
yes.
It was in Philadelphia at the opening of the National Constitution Center.
All right, so Casey can pick up the story, but as I understood it, Justice Scalia more or less said to Peter, oh, well, you wouldn't understand this because you're not one of us, I'm telling the story very badly. You're not one of us. And Peter was able to say, well, just a moment here. So you see how that sort of separation could have been problematic in the post 9/11 period in terms of what he might say, what his opinions were, and so on. Casey, you might want to comment better on that than I have.
Yeah, because I feel slightly differently. I think, as Sarah said, his being Canadian was who he was. That was hugely important to me. Never, ever would have given that up. But he had grown to love the country. He had done two books, The Century and In Search of America, which took him deeply into the history of the country. And he became very enamored with the Founding Fathers and the values of the Founding Fathers and of the Constitution itself. And so that was the beginning of 9/11, absolutely. He then felt, as Sarah said, that he needed to be part of this. But I also think, frankly, it was a country he lived in, he was part of, and he wanted to vote. He wanted to be a full part of the land he lived in without taking anything at all away from Canada, which he treasured. So I think that was important to him. So I think it was a combination of factors, but he never, he kept it quiet for a number of reasons. One, he felt it was a private issue. But secondly, he never wanted anyone to think he had done it for cynical reasons, that he did it to deflect the criticism. He had stood up to criticism for many, many years about not taking citizenship. And he didn't want anyone to think that he did it because he couldn't take it.
And I have to say, excuse me, Casey,
yeah, sure.
I used to travel down to visit Pete. I had the luck of going many times. And it was very interesting how almost invariably on any trip, Americans would say to me, wow, when's Pete going to become an American? So, you know, out of sheer stubbornness at one level, I think he wasn't going to succumb to that kind of pressure.
That's right.
But I think Casey's correct that he wanted to show his loyalty and identity to the story when this occurred, but in no way diminished his absolute devotion to Canada, his commitment to Canada. And incidentally, on his reporting, if there were stories like take the 95 referendum, he moved the entire broadcast up to Montreal because he was so keenly interested in what was going on in the country, and he never lost that interest.
And he felt it was incredibly important that Americans understand what was happening in Canada, and that it's, you know, one of our many failings that we don't pay enough attention to the rest of the world and weren't paying enough attention to our northern neighbor. And he could bring that to us.
I only have a minute and a half left with the two of you. This has just flown.
Then you have to finish it on a fun note, because Peter would be horrified at all this serious discussion. Ask about the millennium when he was on the air for 24 hours having a ball.
That was fun. That was really grand. But, you know, I just to pull it back to something maybe not so much fun, although, you know what, Sarah, you're right. When he came back to visit Canada in the summer, there was this sort of three-week stage he had to go through, right?
Right.
First week?
Insufferable.
Second week?
Coming down to earth.
And then third week?
Human again.
Oh, there you go. I also will muse, because we can't really answer this in the time that we have, what he would make of the sort of move towards infotainment. And he so prized context and analysis and truth and depth.
Well, he fought it relentlessly and always tried to treat news as news, in my opinion.
And I think Shelley, you hit it the nail on the head when you talked about truth. I think that was what he saw as his essential job, was the search for the truth, and he understood just how complicated and hard that was.
Okay, so I've got to leave it there. And Sarah, thank you both so much. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you, and thank you for the book.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Case Fried Jennings, co-editor of Peter Jennings, A Reporter's Life, and Sarah Jennings, Peter's sister, and she joined us from Ottawa. That's the best of Sounds Like Canada. Highlights from our show on CBC Radio 1, heard weekday mornings at 10 o'clock. I'm Sheila Rogers. Thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology, so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.